Three, two, one. Roger Redfern won't talk. He heads up the Interior Airboaters Association, and he says the group's lawyer told them to clam up until they're ready to respond legally to the Game Board's ban of airboats for moose hunting. But Charles Livingston is so mad, he can't help talking, even if it riles his fellow airboaters. Livingston dismisses complaints that the craft damages the environment, though he does admit they're loud.
So is an aircraft until it gets airborne. I sat at Minto pike fishing. I could hear jet boats trying to get up on their trailers, and that's 13 miles away at the landing below Minto Flats. Airboats are loud. I'm not saying they're not loud, but they're loud temporarily till they pass you by.
Livingston says new technology will soon make airboats as quiet as any other craft in the state. Maybe so, says John Peterson, but right now they're too loud. As a physics professor, Peterson's demonstration on airboat noise helped the Game Board make its decision last week to ban the boats from parts of the Tenenhaw Flats. Peterson says the decibels of noise airboats kick out spooks game for other hunters. And Peterson joins other critics who say airboats give an unfair advantage to hunters. Technologically, you have to draw the line somewhere, he says.
You know, if we wanted to, we could allow people to fly over there with helicopters and infrared sighters and rockets and every other thing and shoot out every moose in no time at all. But we have to find some point where it's fair. And personally, I think that airboats are across the line.
Peterson points to statistics that show airboaters are twice as successful bagging game as other boat users. But airboater Livingston counters, saying all-terrain vehicles can drive in the same area. He calls the Game Board's decision discriminatory and says if airboaters end up looking for legal redress, it's because they didn't get a fair hearing with the Game Board. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Chris Davenport, a ski racer and coach from Aspen, had the highest score of the 36 competitors. He says winning the competition was both a surprise and an unbelievable achievement, the best of his skiing career.
I think that the difficult conditions this year, meaning the hard snow, worked to my advantage in that I'm a technically strong skier and I was able to, you know, ski fairly fast and be confident in the terrain that we were given.
First among the women, and 11th overall, was Wendy Fisher of Incline Village, Nevada. Like Davenport, she has a ski racing background and credits her technical skills for leading her to victory. Both Fisher and Davenport pulled ahead of the pack on Mount Teagle, a new site that was used the last 2 days of the competition. Most of the competitors had better scores on Teagle than they did on Odyssey Mountain, the venue for day one. Davenport says winning the world championships will be the first thing he remembers about WESC, but the friendliness and involvement of Aldi's residents will stick with him as well. Executive Director Martha Rue says the many townspeople who volunteered for WESC made it a smooth competition. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
Three, two, one. Frontier Flying Service has a new plane in the air. General Manager Bob Hadukovich says the company recently branched out and has begun flying a pressurized King Air turboprop. During a recent demonstration flight, he said the plane is quieter and warmer than most other aircraft flown to rural Alaska.
It's a tough market when you're hauling dogs half the time and mail and people and freight. Where this run will be Fairbanks, Kotzebue, Galena, Anchorage, Galena, Kotzebue, Fairbanks. All of those runs are predominantly people, and that's what this will be used for. So the interior will stay nice, and we're not going to beat it up. It'll be for passenger comfort.
Hadukovich plans to fly the plane 6 days a week. Its advantage, he says, is getting passengers from Fairbanks to Kotzebue by 9 in the morning and back again by early evening. It allows people in the Nana region a way to get to town in a day. People in towns connected to Galena will also find an easier schedule for flights to Anchorage. The plane cruises at more than 300 miles an hour at 25,000 feet. It costs the company about $2 million. Price Hadukovich says would buy 10 Navajo chieftains.
This airplane, we decided we needed a new source of revenue for the company, something that didn't rely so heavily on the mail and the freight. We looked at several markets. The jet doesn't serve Kotzebue to Fairbanks direct. We're not big enough that we're going to scare anybody else into the market.
Frontier started flying the King Air last month. Hadukovich says he'll know this summer whether the gamble's paying off. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Few people will ever see how dark it is at the bottom of the ocean. On a bright day, descending scuba divers float through blue waters that we think of as crystal-like. But if you go farther down, water passes through a deepening range of blues and blue-blacks until, Cindy Vandiver says, it's blacker than you can imagine.
And as you go down, there's the only sign that you're descending is the bioluminescent lights. That you hit animals that flash and light up, and they sort of mark your descent. That's how you can look out the viewport and know that you're actually going somewhere. You don't feel it.
Vandiver is a professor of oceanography at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and a visiting investigator at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. She has been at the ocean's bottom a lot, now as a scientist and for a while as the only woman to pilot Alvin, Woods Hole's deep-sea submersible. Barely big enough for three cramped bodies, the snub-nosed, bold-sided little sub bristles with lights and cameras and long articulated arms that grab what scientists are interested in. Inside Alvin, rectangular portholes and video screens look out on the deep. Without its protection, humans could not survive the ocean pressure. With it, what they see and bring up from down there, Vandiver says, is a world apart. In trying to describe the landscape, she searches for words. She tries bleak and barren, but discards them both.
It differs wherever you go. What comes to mind is where I've worked the most is the mid-ocean ridges, which are mountains on the seafloor. And you get to the top of one of them, and it's black basalt. Looks like pavement, that's liquid pavement that's flowed and then frozen in motion.
It looks bare of life until Alvin gets to the hot springs on the seafloor. Then, Vandiver says, it's like a tropical garden. Imagine Yellowstone underwater, superheated jets over 600 degrees Fahrenheit blasting out of cracks in the ocean floor, cooling quickly to room temperature, cool enough to support animal life. And what life?
The giant tube worms on the East Pacific Rise are 6 feet tall. They're white tubes, so they look like porcelain against the black basalt. So it's very dramatic contrast. And then coming out of the tubes are the red plumes of the animals, their gill-like structures, brilliant crimson red because of the hemoglobin in them. And so they're just beautiful. They look like roses on stalks on the seafloor, and they're in clusters or thickets. There's big meadows of tube worms sometimes.
The tube worms' bright red heads float in clean ocean water, but their feet dangle 6 feet below, dining on a sulfide-rich chemical stew that would poison any other animal, including us.
They have adaptations to avoid that. They have a hemoglobin-like pigment in their blood that grabs a hold of the sulfide and carries it to the bacteria that they have inside of them, and so it keeps it, the sulfide from being poisonous in that way. And there's other adaptations that other animals have to keep the sulfide out of the parts of the biochemistry that would be hurt by it.
Vandiver says geologists knew there were hot springs on the seafloor, but the discovery of tube worms and other animals and how they were making a living for themselves in a food-poor environment was totally unexpected.
In particular, the tube worm is interesting because it's so big, yet it lacks a mouth and a digestive system. It has no way of ingesting food. And so it became a race for the biologist to discover what it was that it's feeding on, and it turned out to be the story of the symbiotic bacteria and its use of chemicals to survive. And that's turned us to look at chemosynthetic communities and in other environments and the bacteria and microorganisms that do this work. They're fixing carbon dioxide the same way a plant would, but they don't need sunlight.
The investigations of life at sea bottom has prompted interest in underwater ecosystems. Also, some investigations at NASA about whether life on Mars might have existed at hydrothermal springs. And now, among scientists generally, about how life might have started on Earth.
When people thought about the origin of life, it was thought of as happening in shallow water, and biologists just hadn't conceived of a system like this where you could have extremely high temperatures, very disequilibrium kinds of conditions that you need to start life.
Vandiver is back at the bottom of the Atlantic this week with a geologist also from Woods Hole and their Alvin pilot. This time, she's looking more closely at non-solar ambient light around the sea vents. She wants to know what's causing it and what shrimp and other animals are seeing in the glow at the bottom of the ocean. Cindy Lee Vandiver has written a book about life undersea, being an Alvin pilot, and her work since then. It's from Addison Wesley, and it's called The Octopus's Garden in Fairbanks. I'm Susan McGinnis.
For lack of a better term, the people of Delta Junction call the swirls and patterns appearing in their fields snow circles. The circle showed up with the comet Hyakutake, says Steve McCombs, a longtime Delta resident. He and his family were out gazing at the comet one night last week.
The next day, we went down the field doing a little cross-country skiing, and there they were, out in the snow, huge swirls. In fact, we got to the edge of them, and the dog laid down, wouldn't go near. But, you know, you just kind of sucked the edge of your ski, and you'd just trail right around it, and really had to kind of fall down to get out of the pull of whatever it was.
McCombs recalls the aurora being especially bright the night before his discovery. He now wonders if those lights weren't the vapor trails of some UFO mothership. While scientists can't explain the snow circles, they dismiss notions of flying saucers. Marine scientist Tom Royer says the swirling patterns remind him of ocean activity.
They're called ocean eddies, and we know that with global warming that things sort of shift northward, so that the things in the Gulf of Alaska could be moving into the Delta area. And the mechanisms are due to the Earth's rotation interacting with the topography. So it could be very likely that the Alaska Range south of Delta would affect these things.
But McCombs doesn't buy Royer's explanation. There's a spooky geometry to the circles, he says.
Real different little patterns, you know, almost tracking and then triangles moving right into the center and then moving back out. It's hard to describe from a ground level. If you could get up high, you'd see more of it, I'm sure.
For many in the Delta area, the circles represent just another woe the community must bear. Recent military cuts have the town scrambling for ways to stave off financial hardship when the nearby army post closes. That's why Cleta Barger, as president of the Delta Chamber of Commerce, is willing to put the best face she can on these disturbing images.
Well, I haven't personally been out to see them yet. I understand that's the talk of the town. Maybe it's due to the comet that came over, or maybe we have some mysterious visitors from somewhere besides Alaska. I don't really care where they came from. We just like people to come and see and bring their money, because we need the money in Delta Junction.
Barger says if they can somehow preserve the patterns, there's even talk of using some of the Army's abandoned buildings as a museum. That way, the town can make economic hay from the snow circles all year long. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
The resolution, which passed unanimously Monday, directs city staff to talk with state officials about the privatization of state prisons. It also calls for a study of the socioeconomic effects of a medium-security prison in Valdez. Corrections Group North, a joint venture of Allvest, WAC, and HUD and VECO, has proposed a private 200-bed prison at Harborview. The city council approved the resolution after hearing the most extensive public comment on the issue to date. Three people spoke for the prison concept, and three spoke against it, including Janko Zaitsevich.
I don't want Valdez to be a prison town. I don't want it to be looked at as such, and I feel it's a quality of life issue.
Zaitsevich says a prison would mean a big change in the community that would not be positive. Other speakers said a prison would bring the wrong class of people to Valdez and not serve the public's interest. Zaitsevich says a public vote on the issue would result in a clear and resounding no. Mayor John Harris says there should be a referendum if the public seems closely divided on the issue, but until the public's opinion of the idea becomes clear, the city needs to at least keep the possibility open.
I believe it's too important of an issue to just say, no, we're not interested in looking at it. We have to take a very serious look at it and weigh all the possibilities. And so should the public.
Councilman Tim Plummer says 100 jobs will be lost if Harborview closes, and he's not ready to let those jobs go without studying the alternatives. He says a prison at Harborview might be the only way to replace them. Cheryl Jacobs says businesses in Valdez are already hurting because of job cuts at the Alyeska Marine Terminal, and losing another 100 jobs would make matters that much worse. Jacobs spoke in favor of the prison concept, although she says she doesn't want a prison in Valdez.
If there was some other way for Harborview to stay open and keep those people, I would much rather have that. But I don't, at this point, they've checked into it, and I don't think there's anything else to take its place, and they've got to check it out.
Other speakers said there's nothing wrong with a prison town and commended city council for looking into the idea. But council also heard that people don't have enough information about the proposal to make an informed choice yet. The Chamber of Commerce has scheduled a public meeting on the issue for April 9th. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
In the 1970s, when the federal government passed the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, money and land was distributed to more than 200 village Native corporations. At that time, the communities of Kaltag, Nulato, Kaikuk, and Galena realized that if they joined forces, they could create a stronger company. They formed Ganiyu Limited, and the corporation originally initiated several businesses, ranging from an air transportation service to a hardware store, none of which survived. Ganiyu's most recent effort to make money comes in the form of joint ventures. The corporation just signed a contract for a 50-50 joint venture with Statewide Services Corporation to cook and clean for the staff of the Illinois Creek Gold Mine, located about 55 miles southwest of Galena. Ganiyu has worked with Statewide for the past 7 years on the Wakatna Lodge in Galena, providing room and board for workers and other visitors. Ganiyu President Fred Stickman says the Illinois Creek Project meets two of the corporation's goals.
We look at this as, first of all, a venture to make monies to benefit shareholders, hopefully by making enough to increase our dividend that we hope to distribute in the future. And of course, the second thing that's important to the board members are the employment possibilities of the local shareholders.
The company is responding to its shareholders. Ganiyu recently distributed its first dividend in 12 years. And last week, the board of directors voted to set aside a fund made up of 25% of the corporation's after-tax profits each year to distribute dividends, scholarships, and other benefits. General Manager Bruce Kling says the company has had to struggle to make up for the losses it suffered in the early years.
In the last 6 years, the corporation's had a profit averaging about $200,000 a year, and started recovering those accumulated losses back. And this year, the board felt confident enough that they declared a dividend and distributed some of the profit.
Currently, Ganiyu is involved in several businesses, including property management in all four villages and Anchorage. Kling says the corporation also leases land, but investment income and profit sharing from the regional corporations account for most of Ganiyu's earnings. Some future endeavors of the corporation include joint ventures on construction projects like local roads and a new water plant in Galena. Kling says that Ganiyu's primary goal is to support local businesses, not compete with them. In Galena, I'm Teresa Bacher.
When a new board took over at Palmers Valley Hospital in the spring of 1992, it quickly moved to restrict abortion services. By October, it had the votes to limit abortions to only cases of rape, incest, or when the mother's health is in danger. A month later, abortion rights advocates filed suit. Matsu Coalition for Choice says, among other things, the hospital was built with public dollars, is non-sectarian, and therefore cannot ban any legal medical procedures. Superior Court Judge Dana Fabe recently agreed and ordered the hospital to allow abortions. But Valley Hospital Director Cliff Orham says under current board policy, a majority of hospital association members support the current limitations.
It's comprised this year of about 2,500 local community citizens that submit applications for membership in the association. So it's $5 to become an association member. And that gives you a right to vote and elect an association board, which in turn elects an operating board. And so theoretically, the issues from the community are brought to the operating board, and the desires of the community are made known through the association.
Orham says the association represents the desires of the community in restricting abortions. Critics, though, argue that the association and the board are packed with abortion opponents who they say don't reflect the views of most of the community. Matsu Coalition for Choice member Howard Best says he's optimistic that the Supreme Court will uphold the lower court's decision.
The situation, I would call it stable. I have no idea what the anti-abortion people might do once the Supreme Court hands down the decision. We are very confident that we're going to win at that level also. The issues in the case, to us, seem so clear-cut.
Bess says while he believes the court will decide with his group, he's not sure what the decision will be until it's done. The hospital is appealing the case to the Supreme Court and asked the court to let its restrictions stand until the final ruling. The court denied that motion and ordered the hospital to allow elective abortions. Hospital officials say they will abide by the order pending the ruling on this latest appeal. In Talkeetna, I'm Kathy Sullivan.
Armed with a 4-inch chisel, Tony Parker is paring down what will soon become the tail end of 30 feet of angry sperm whale. At his side, Captain Ahab hangs from a harpoon while a boatload of his shipmates look on in awe. It's a common expression among visitors to the ice park, where 2 weeks ago, carvers like Parker turned 4-foot ice cubes into detailed sculptures.
Basically, it's like taking a piece of crystal that doesn't really shatter, you know, and you can mold anything you want. Because when you're finally done with it, that's basically what it looks like. It is a piece of crystal, and it's like making this beautiful art form. You know, you have to be real. You got to have so much equipment to make like glass and crystal and things like that. With ice, you know, a chisel, a chainsaw, little things like that, a knife, you can create things. Anybody can do it.
On this day, barely 24 hours before judges will call a halt to the work, carvers perform a frenzied ballet. They're stacking, grinding, chipping, shaving, and of course, sawing, while all the time fighting warm temperatures that destroy the strength and structure these carvers depend on.
You create what you want out of it. Unfortunately, it melts, but it's something you can do over and over and over. It's not something where it costs a lot of money. You know, water is not the most expensive product, and it's something that, you know, a lot of people can get into inexpensively, rather than wood carvers where you have to buy the wood and marble and things like that. You know, ice is probably the cheapest form of art you can start into, realistically, because it's the cleanest. You carve what you want to carve, you let it melt, there's no cleanup. The water goes away, you don't have wood chips to throw away. That's what's kind of nice about it and what draws a lot of people to it. You do it, it's up, it's gone, you know, no more.
It's a perfect art form for Alaska, a place where sooner, usually not later, nature wins all battles, a place where carvers of all sorts find it's easier to accept the land's gifts, knowing full well that they must soon be returned. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Three, two, one. The 6th annual World Extreme Skiing Championships are taking place this weekend in the Chugach Mountains near Valdez. 34 competitors from 7 countries will put their skills to the test on 40 to 50 degree slopes. Helicopters will bring them to the top, and how well they make their way down will determine who gets the world's top male and female extreme skier crowns. The competitors will be judged according to such things as the difficulty of the runs they make, the technique they use, and how much control they exert. More than 400 inches of snow has fallen at Thompson Pass this year, less than normal. Because of that, Todd Jones, a guide with Valley's Heli Ski Guides, predicts a more technically challenging West this year, requiring more heads-up skiing.
Where you see snow isn't necessarily where you can ski. You can't just launch any cliff. You kind of got to pick your way through, look where there's going to be good snow, ski a little more controlled technical lines, stuff like that. This year is going to probably work a lot better than just skiing wide open, launching big airs and speedering, because it's a lot more exposed rocks. It could be a lot more dangerous just if you're really skiing wide open.
The competition will get underway tomorrow on Odyssey Mountain, easily viewed from the Richardson Highway just north of Thompson Pass. The sites of Sunday and Monday's competition have not yet been announced. Tuesday is set aside as a weather day if needed, but otherwise the winners of WESC 1996 should be announced during an award ceremony Monday night. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
Kuna Dog Marshals Association Vice President Fred Huntington says the Spring Carnival means more to the community than just playing games.
These kind of things we like to have in our community, especially for these young kids. We want to see these young kids grow up with what we had when we were kids, you know, because Spring Carnival is a very special event in our community on the river here.
All right, the first racer is just about ready to go.
There he goes, and they're off. First one, Bill Kornmuller.
19 dogs.
And boy, they're really headed out. They're running.
That's a lot of dog power.
The Galena 16-mile open dog sled race has attracted mushers and spectators from across the state for the past 48 years. This year, Willow musher Bill Kornmuller won the race with a time more than 4 minutes faster than that of second-place finisher Rudy Demoski. Kornmuller took home a $2,000 purse, and Demoski earned himself a $1,700 check. Rough river ice and low snowfall forced the dog mushers to reroute this year's racetrack across the river and through Cali Slough. Normally, the dog teams stay on the river. Race enthusiast Russ Sweetser checked out the course.
Taking a ride along the trail, I'll tell you, you're going to have to be a good dog musher this year. This is the first time that I know that we've gone through the slough. After you come off the river, go start through the slough. You take that sharp little turn as you come off the river and go around that corner. Then you head on up into the slough, and you'll cross back and forth, and you just got to be on your toes.
Dog races are just one of the events featured at Spring Carnival. Local athletes compete in snowshoe races and ice pick contests and even dance contests like the waltz, the jitterbug, and the chicken. As she told Bob Summer, Carol Huntington enjoyed herself at the dog race but wondered when her favorite event would start.
Oh, it's so beautiful out today. When is the ladies' snowshoe race? It's going to be a warm race for them. They better come down in their bathing suits.
Where's your snowshoes?
I loaned them out to my daughter-in-law. She's running the race.
Huntington's daughter-in-law, Florine Drake, won this year's women's one-mile snowshoe race across the river and back. Neil Summer from Nulato finished first in the open four-mile event. Kel-Tec resident Earl Esmalka won the ice pick contest. He chopped through the river ice and reached water in just over 40 minutes. Estimates of the depth of the ice in front of Old Town Galena at the contest site ranged from 4.5 to 5 feet deep. Galena resident Charlotte Evans attended the carnival events and summed up the feeling of the weekend.
It was nice and warm, light wind. I mean, it was perfect.
People will continue to gather for spring carnivals up and down the river over the next 2 weekends. Nulato residents are sponsoring their 28th annual carnival this week, and the community of Kaikuk celebrates the arrival of spring with a carnival this weekend. The 17th annual Kaikuk River Championship gets started in Hooslea April 2nd, and the Ruby Dog Mushers Association will hold the 1996 Spring Carnival in memory of Johnny May in Ruby April 4th through the 7th. In Galena, I'm Teresa Bacher.
For thousands of years, tremendous amounts of snow and ice from the south side of Mount McKinley have fallen to the valley floor. Squeezed by time and motion, it has formed a glacier that moves at 3 feet per day. In 1991, Bradford Washburn, believing the gorge must be damn deep, asked glaciologist Keith Echelmeyer if the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska could help find out just how deep the gorge was. Echelmeyer and others used a radar system in 91, but left unable to say anything except that it really was damn deep. In 1992, Washburn, Echelmeyer, and five other researchers tried again.
We use seismic methods. We put some dynamite in a hole and blow it up, and then it makes elastic waves go basically down to the bottom of the glacier and bounce off the bottom and come up. And then we record how long that takes. Then we can determine where the waves came from, so we can see that some bounce off the sides and some from the bottom. And they travel through the glacier, and the glacier's almost entirely ice. It's 99.9% ice. It's very little rock. The only rock that's there is a little bit on the surface, or most of the rock is just a little rock along the surface of the glacier that accumulates as rock falls onto it.
Their findings showed the glacier to be 3,800 feet deep for people camped in the gorge. Mount Dickey towers 5,000 feet above, and a wall of granite cliffs throw shadows across this moving river of ice. The Ruth Gorge brings people every year from around the world to climb and view its spectacular beauty. In Talkeetna, I'm Kathy Sullivan.
Early on a difficult climb, especially a difficult solo climb,
You constantly feel the abyss pulling at your back. To resist takes a tremendous conscious effort. You don't dare let your guard down for an instant. But as the climb goes on, you grow accustomed to the exposure. You get used to rubbing shoulders with doom. You come to believe in the reliability of your hands and feet and head. You learn to trust your self-control. Hours fly by like minutes. The accumulated clutter of day-to-day existence, the lapses of conscience, the unpaid bills, the bungled opportunities, the dust under the couch, the inescapable prison of your genes, all of that is temporarily forgotten, crowded from your thoughts by an overpowering clarity of purpose and by the seriousness of the task at hand. I've gained nearly 700 feet of altitude since stepping off the hanging glacier, all of it on crampon front points and the picks of my axis. The ribbon of frozen meltwater had ended 300 feet up and was followed by a crumbly armor of frost feathers. Though just barely substantial enough to support body weight, the rime was plastered over the rock to a thickness of 2 or 3 feet, so I kept plugging upward. The wall, however, had been growing imperceptibly steeper, and as it did so, the frost feathers became thinner. I'd fallen into a slow, hypnotic rhythm, swing, swing, kick, kick, swing, swing, kick, kick, when my left ice axe slammed into a slab of diorite a few inches beneath the rime. I tried to the left, then right, but kept striking rock. The frost feathers holding me up, it became apparent, were maybe 5 inches thick and had the structural integrity of stale cornbread. Below was 3,700 feet of air, and I was balanced on a house of cards. The sour taste of panic rose in my throat. My eyesight blurred. I began to hyperventilate. My calves started to shake. I shuffled a few feet farther to the right, hoping to find thicker ice, but managed only to bend an ice axe on the rock. Awkwardly, stiff with fear, I started working my way back down. The rime gradually thickened. After descending about 80 feet, I got back on reasonably solid ground. I stopped for a long time to let my nerves settle, then leaned back from my tools and stared up at the face above, searching for a hint of solid ice, for some variation in the underlying rock strata, for anything that would allow passage over the frosted slabs. I looked until my neck ached, but nothing appeared. The climb was over. The only place to go was down.
Tammy Schnitzer grew up a good Lutheran girl in Billings, Montana, but it wasn't until she met her husband and converted to Judaism that she learned what it was like to be hated. Because she took a high profile as a Jew, she started getting death threats. One day, while backing out her driveway with her young son in the car, her window was shot out. But for all the heat, she says complacency is her biggest enemy.
The hurdles weren't particularly skinheads that were deterring my son from speaking out of who he was. It wasn't the neo-Nazis. A lot of it had to do with indifference and apathy. A lot of it was trying to get good people to do good things. That's not a real easy job to do, and those are the main struggles and the main hurdles. Those are the things that keep you up at night and maybe bring a tear to your eye. It has nothing to do with bricks through windows or bullets through glass.
Schnitzer's become a human rights activist, created a program called Not in Our Town, has been taking her message across the nation. She detoured to Fairbanks Tuesday for an 18-hour visit. To illustrate her point about getting people involved, she tells about the bomb threats her synagogue received and how tough it was to get hospital administrators to allow Jews a temporary gathering place while the bomb squad searched the temple across the street.
Went to the clergy, and the clergy said, well, he didn't really feel comfortable in making that decision for us, and referred us to the vice president. She then said she wasn't comfortable with that decision. And 3 days later, the president came back and denied us access to the hospital. The president employs 2,000 people. He's the president of the Billings Chamber of Commerce. My husband's employed by this hospital. A third of our Jewish population is employed by this hospital. And so our job, not as a Jewish community, because my Jewish community was very accepting of this and did not want to rock the boat, because after all, we were quote-unquote good neighbors for many, many years. Our job as community people and community members in particular the clergy, got together and discussed with Mr. Paquette, the hospital administrator, that writing that pencil in difference was truly taking the side of the perpetrator. You know, and the administrator would say, well, you don't want to wreck the boat here. You know, we've been good neighbors, and let's not do this. You know, you don't understand. It takes a lot to evacuate a hospital, and these people truly are a threat to the hospital. And then we'd respond back by saying, you know, well, if you had a problem within your hospital, we'd open our doors gladly, invite you in, and we'd suffer the consequences later. This is what good neighbors do. And he'd say, well, you make it sound like I'm throwing women and children out in the cold and the dark. He was throwing women and children out in the cold and the dark. And then finally, it ended up by saying he would have seen us after the bomb went off. Why couldn't he have seen us before? And he would have been just as much of a danger that way. And then he suddenly understood. But it took a good 2 days of negotiating for him to understand. And at one point, he felt very threatened by it. But now he has been a real advocate for the community, has provided our congregation with lighting and security. But again, that was one of many struggles of getting good people to do good things.
Schnitzer expects Fairbanksians will face the same hurdles when dealing with intolerance in this town. But she says people need to be reminded that bigotry is not just an issue between a synagogue and a hospital. Rather, it's between every citizen in each community. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Last year, Borough drivers violated Clean Air Act standards for carbon monoxide 9 times. Under the law, that means EPA will reclassify the borough, requiring drivers to once again use oxygenated fuel. 4 years ago, that meant using MTBE, but citizen complaints delayed the program. Now oxyfuels may be back, but MTBE won't be. Instead, cars will burn ethanol, a type of the alcohol that many drivers already use to prevent gas line freezing. Fairbanks North Star Borough Transportation Director Max Lyon.
The state did a drivability study and a limited double-blind study for perceived health effects. It wasn't really that scientific as the MTBE tests that were conducted. And wasn't much of a difference between the ethanol and the straight gasoline that was used on the preliminary results.
But Borough Mayor Jim Sampson opposes using oxyfuel. So exactly what the assembly will do to meet clean air standards remains uncertain. During a meeting of the Pollution Control Advisory Commission, members suggested one way to make the program more convenient for drivers by testing cars every other year, though Lyon says that may not save drivers much money.
Currently, we test about 45,000 or so vehicles, and we charge $10 per certificate. So that covers the cost of the program. But if we go to biennial testing and we go down to 22,000 vehicles we tested, then our funding will be cut in half.
While the commission recommended relatively small adjustments, federal law requires major changes, not only in fuel, but in the way we use our automobiles. Exactly how these changes will happen will be worked out over the summer to be ready for next winter. In Fairbanks, I'm Fred Brantingham.
Lifelong McGrath resident and fur trapper Russell Ivey was among those testifying before the Board of Game Sunday in Fairbanks. Local native corporation MTNT paid for Ivey's trip so that he could voice shareholders' concerns about dwindling area moose numbers and stalled wolf control efforts.
I told them how good it was when people were flying and shooting them and shooting out of the plane. How many moose and how quick they came back. And then I told them exactly what was happening right now. There's so few moose that the wolf is cleaning up his kill, where if there's a good amount of moose, the wolf will only eat the best parts of that animal.
Ivy and many other area residents would like to see the return of aerial wolf hunting and bounties as a means to bolster moose numbers for local hunters. The Game Board approved wolf control for the upper Kuskokwim Valley, including the McGrath area, as well as for an area near Delta Junction during their fall meeting last October. But no action has been taken as the state is considering how to approach the touchy political issue. Governor Tony Knowles halted state wolf control efforts south of Fairbanks last winter after a wolf was videotaped trying to chew off a foot to free itself from a state snare, and another was filmed being shot several times by a state employee before being killed. In McGrath, I'm Dan Brock.
The night before the spill, Mike Lewis was at a meeting. The Valdez City Council had formed a committee on the effects of oil development. Mostly it was concerned with economic effects, but Lewis was on an environmental subcommittee, and at that meeting, marine biologist Ricky Ott was teleconferencing in from Cordova.
And about 10:30 that night, we were talking about some of the potential hazardous impacts of oil development, and she said, and her voice came wafting electronically through the room, "It's not a matter of if there will be a major oil spill in Prince William Sound, but when." And at that moment that she said that, the Exxon Valdez was casting off from the moorings across the bay and heading out for Blairee.
The next morning, the clock radio came on at 6. It was the lead story on KCHU. The massive tanker was on the rocks, hemorrhaging oil.
I thought it was a cruel joke at first. I couldn't believe that it really happened. But we both looked at each other and we said, "This is it. This is the big one." And we knew.
Mike Lewis's wife, L.J. Evans, was teaching photography at the community college. She grabbed her cameras, and by afternoon, Evans, the city attorney, and their pilot were in the air. They circled the tanker as tightly as they could.
And I slid from side to side in the bench seat in the back of the Cessna, taking pictures out of one side and then the other. At the time that we arrived, there was just at the time, 2:30 in the afternoon, that the response vessels were arriving. There was a skimmer coming. The tanker was listing to one side. It was enormous, and it looked like brown pancake on the water, spreading away from it.
Lewis, too, thought first to record what was happening. He took his video equipment down to the harbor. The night of the 24th, he caught a boat ride out to the spill area with Alyeska's first crew change.
When I arrived that night, it was dark, and there were strange smells around, strange sounds, and lights flashing, and men shouting at each other and moving strange equipment around. It was a period of visual and auditory dissonance. Prince William Sound is an incredibly beautiful place. You know, there are mountains covered with snow and glaciers and the beautiful water and wildlife and animals everywhere. And all the time I was out there, this was all present. This wasn't affected. It was still there. But then you would turn 10 degrees one direction and you would see this incredible industrial activity. A huge floating drilling rig, or thousands of people out on the beach spraying water, and big floating platforms and helicopters everywhere, and the dissonance between those two images was overwhelming all the time.
The community college was remodeling, and some of its empty rooms were turned into a rescue center for otters and birds. Evans went over to see what she could do and ended up answering phones, and then later she helped with oil-soaked birds.
They just sort of huddle. They're unhappy. You can't catch them until they're weak. So they're already pretty sick. Unless they're totally glopped. If they're totally coated so they can't fly, they can't really flap very well, then you can get them when they're in pretty good condition. They haven't had a chance to try to preen the oil off and absorb it. The otter screamed.
It's hard to remember.
I still sometimes have dreams where those sounds are present, a lot less, but I did have quite a few of them for a while. It's a very unnerving sound.
Other spills in other places had taught responders how to clean and restore feathers. In 1989, though, little was known about otters.
One of the things that we talked about later on in the summer that was, you know, a macabre thing, really, they learned a lot about sea otter physiology and what they eat and how to rehabilitate them. They just learned tremendous amounts of things about sea otters because of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Sort of costly research.
Like the birds and the otters, Mike Lewis says the native people who depend on Prince William Sound suffered their own losses.
For people who live close to the land and who live in a very close relationship to the animals and plants that they eat, the spiritual strength of their spiritual strength is very much tied with the spiritual strength of their food supply, their subsistence base. And when they see the seals and when they see the bivalves and the seaweed coated with oil, that image interrupts that spiritual continuity. And it takes a long, long, long time to overcome that.
The people of Chinega and other small communities around the Sound, especially those who live traditionally, were affected in other ways, too.
This forced the 20th century in upon all these people. Suddenly there were 10,000 people from the lower 48 in their territory, plus there were opportunities for them to work in the job economy to be able to buy the food that they could no longer get locally.
Lewis believes both these impacts will be long-lasting.
The trust in the subsistence base will take probably generations to come back, because the images will always be there. Just as they are in our heads, they're still in the heads of the people who still live there now. And their children, it will be a little bit less. They'll know the stories, but they will not have seen it. And then their children's children then probably will be enough in the past that if indeed the money economy doesn't interfere with the reestablishment of that relationship with the subsistence base again.
While people are still dealing with spill effects, so are the beaches. Evans has visited the shores around Prince William Sound every year since 1989. Much, he says, has changed. Still, on maybe a dozen beaches, a prodding with a shovel would turn up oil today.
And the one place I'm thinking of in particular is a place called Rua Cove. It's just on the east side of Night Island. It's a little dimple beach. And there's a few places up there where you can go up behind some big boulders, big as me boulders, and turn over a rock, and there's oil that you can scoop out with a spoon, about the consistency of yogurt. But if you didn't know where to go look, if you didn't know what you were looking at when you saw it, you might not know what it is. So that, I wouldn't have believed that it would ever look that good in 1989. Could not have convinced me it was ever going to look like that. But that stuff that's there now might be there for another 20 years.
Evans and Lewis's lives were also changed by the spill. She stayed directly involved, going to work for the trustee council that distributes settlement funds and oversees research and recovery efforts. Lewis, moved by what happened to people's lives, returned to school. He now works with the University of Alaska Museum, helping to preserve Alaska's native artifacts. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
It's an issue in the hearts and minds of many Alaskans. How to have a timber industry in the Tanana Valley that's big enough to provide jobs now and support consumer needs, but will also protect workers and the forests over time. Jan Daw, co-director of the Alaska Boreal Forest Council, says people from a variety of backgrounds are gathering this weekend to discuss ways to build a sustainable forest industry.
We can diversify our economy and honor the multiple cultures that live and depend on the resource base, and do so in an ecologically safe way if we get all of the concerns together and plan for that future. That future, the sound stewardship of boreal forest resources in interior Alaska, is the mission of Alaska Boreal Forest Council.
Daw says the Forest Council is bringing up speakers who have experience in the industry. Former Commerce Commissioner Larry Merkuliev will be there, and loggers who have dealt with this issue in Oregon and Montana. The council was formed in 1991 after lawmakers pursued a plan to increase logging of the area forests. That plan, which would have opened local forests to major corporations, was widely opposed. Council members were concerned that the legislature was moving too fast and logging in the interior needed more consideration. They said small local logging operations would be shut out if the big companies were brought in. Representative John Davies says the issue of small versus large-scale logging does need to be resolved. He says a lot of people support small logging, but the small companies can't always afford to compete with the big ones. Davies suggests it may be necessary to redefine the way the industry looks at the Alaskan forest.
I think that we do need to try to figure out perhaps a new way of looking at what sustainability means in a northern boreal forest. And I don't think that we've really, certainly as a community, we haven't really come to grips with that question. And I think it's essential that we do that.
Davies plans to attend at least part of the conference. Organizers hope information from this workshop filters back to lawmakers who are currently debating two House bills. One of those bills would allow for timber sales of up to 10 million board feet and promote local manufacture of value-added wood products. The other bill calls for land use plans to be developed for all contracts larger than 10 acres. In Fairbanks, I'm Vicki Doran. As the AIP hammered out its platform and elected new officers, one theme became clear. The party needs to reach out to a broader base of voters. With 65% of Alaska's voters not affiliated with either the Republican or Democratic parties, there's clearly potential for growth. But on the party platform itself, leaders remain divided. Newly elected state treasurer Doug Welton says that as long as the federal government continues to make and change the rules, Alaskans will never have control over state lands and resources.
I have never swayed from my goal and what I perceive as this party's goal, and that's to achieve independence for this nation, for this state, to be a nation. I have no doubt that we have no business being affiliated with or a part of that United States down there.
But new state party chairman Jack Coghill says the party's goals should appeal to a broad range of Alaskan voters. He plans to change the AIP's emphasis to a state's rights platform that opposes federal control of Alaska's resources.
I hope, as chairman, to be able to broaden that base to allow people with thoughts other than just a narrow line of let's demand constitutional separation or let's demand constitutional reform, to go into other areas of interest in the state. The miners are in trouble. The timber people are in trouble. The hunter and the sportsman are in trouble. The native people are in trouble. Everybody's in trouble in Alaska, and they're all in trouble because of federal intervention.
Leaders are working toward changes in laws which currently allow the federal government to manage Alaska's fish and game in the broad national interest. They also support the current split on mineral development on federal land, under which Alaska gets 90% of royalties. They say that as long as the federal government can decide whether Alaskans can drill for oil, it can use that as a hammer to negotiate for a bigger percentage of the royalties, such as the 50-50 split proposed for opening ANWR. The party counts 15,000 members among Alaska's 380,000 registered voters. Membership is growing at 7% a year, and it's reaching out to voters on the Internet. The party has only one declared candidate for office, and district organizing is just beginning. Welton concedes that their goal of becoming Alaska's lead party will not happen overnight.
I can only hope that through this party and the efforts of some very strong-willed individuals that we can get the word out and educate. I think that's the key. More than money, I think educate is the key. And it's going to take a considerable amount of time. Joe Vogler gave over 20 years of his life, and he only put a dent in it.
In addition to Welton and Coghill, Bob Logan and Wasilla's Mark Kreisen were elected as vice chairs, and Lynette Clark will serve as secretary. In Fairbanks, I'm Marilee McDonald.
The game board meeting in Fairbanks heard caribou researcher Pat Valkenburg report calf weight is down in the Neltina herd. That, combined with lower calf-to-cow ratio and shifting winter ranges, could signal a potential population crash in the herd, says Valkenburg.
At this point, I believe that it would be prudent for the department to recommend reducing the size of the Neltina herd to below 40,000. If it turns out that this decline in condition and body weight is something temporary and it looks like it's more related to weather than it is to density, we can always allow the herd to increase in the future.
Game managers fear history repeating itself. In the late 1960s and early 70s, the Neltina herd's numbers plummeted from 70 to 10,000 animals. Biologists are still uncertain on the causes, and they admit even if the current herd size is reduced through intensive harvesting, there are no guarantees another crash won't occur. Pat Valkenburg.
I think it's possible for caribou herds to crash at any time, at any population level. All I'm saying is that I think the chances of a decline will be reduced if we reduce herd size.
Cutting the Neltina population to 40,000 would possibly open the herd to tens of thousands of hunters. Fish and game managers came up with several scenarios for reducing the population, and the game board set up a special committee Monday to consider strategies. They report to the board Thursday morning as part of the week-long meeting. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Thinking that the world we see is actually the world that's out there, we forget how many different ways of seeing and knowing there really are. So says Ellen Belosky, an archaeologist who studies how we know what we know. Belosky is a research associate with the University of Calgary's Arctic Institute of North America. Her research emerged from years as an Arctic archaeologist when she found herself watching Western scientists and Inuit hunters. She says they see things very differently and don't share much of what they see.
They don't communicate with each other, and they don't necessarily communicate what they know to anyone else besides their own kind.
Inuit hunters and Western wildlife managers, for example, observe, count, and draw conclusions about the health of animal populations. Native hunters traditionally watch a herd over a long period of time.
They would observe and carry the knowledge of those herds over several generations, human generations, I mean, because they were always learning from their parents and grandparents and passing that knowledge on to their children.
In contrast, the science of wildlife management is young and different.
Wildlife managers rely far more on quantitative or numbers information taken at set locations in short periods of time. And so the two groups of people are dealing with different information, and because they are isolated from each other and their information is isolated from each other, then neither benefits from what the other learns.
The two groups end up in conflict over things like if, where, when, and how many animals should be harvested. Differing relationships with the land and different concepts of time often lay at the root of things.
The way that plays out in a modern-day conflict, for example, is the timetable a manager from the government or, for example, a corporation that wants to develop some resource near a native community or on native lands. They have a timetable, and that timetable is very specific, it's very driven, it's often tied to a market, it's tied to a fiscal year, it's tied to a performance appraisal that the government manager may be facing, for example.
In general terms, Velasquez says native time tends to be much more circular, without linear progressions from worse to better or past to present.
Native people aren't just stalling when they say, well, we don't have that timetable. Our timetable, the critical parts of our timetable, may, for example, be something like we have to look ahead seven generations to what that will mean for our children. And people live those things today. That's not, that concept of time is not an artifact of some native past that's no longer present in today's world. It's very much there for people.
Belosky has been doing her postdoctoral work on these different ways of knowing. She's currently in Anchorage working as the executive director of Keepers of the Treasure Alaska, overseeing the implementation of the Native American Graves Repatriation Act. She says there are signs that our cultural blinders are falling away. Increasing political power has met a stronger voice for Northern Indigenous people, and Western scientists are tending to look with some greater interest at other world views.
But also through some of the difficulties Western society is experiencing with pollution, for example, the breakdown of the ozone layer, all these things that we don't know a lot about, but we understand that our impact on the world and the way that we have learned about the world and made decisions in it is proven to have some major flaws.
As a researcher, Belosky says, she's less interested in who's got the right answer and more in what the answers tell us, both about the world and the people who look at it.
We need to examine the premises of our own method and our own way of doing things. And then with very open minds, we need to look at other ways of doing things and try to understand how those are different. But not say, oh, Native knowledge could be useful to science, as if it's something you kind of extract and plug into the way Western science works.
Ellen Belosky speaks tonight at the new Natural Sciences Building on the UAF campus at 7 o'clock. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
3, 2, 1. The world is changing rapidly, says Red Book editor Harriet Lyon, and that requires schools to adjust their traditional ideas of education. For the past 5 years, Lyon says the magazine has acknowledged one school from each state based on how creatively it responds to these rapid changes. For the last 3 years, Fairbanks schools have represented Alaska, and this year,
it was West Valley High's turn.
I think essentially we were very attracted to its Passports Project, where seniors shadow local professionals and practice their interview skills and complete job applications and conduct computer searches for college and employment opportunities. That seemed a very innovative program, very hands-on. It was really preparing students for life in the 21st century.
It's the overwhelming number of choices facing high school graduates today which sparked the Passports Project, says West Valley teacher Sean Frasca. There are thousands of colleges, not to mention voc ed and junior college programs out there. And statistics say 80% of the job market asks for training beyond what can be learned in high school. Plus, says Frasca, students today can look forward to more than one career.
I think the number is up to 7 now, the number of career changes that these kids that are in high school today will be faced with during their lifetime. So it's not just being focused on the career that they're interested in or the job area that they're interested in, but it's being aware of all the different choices.
And more than that, says West Valley's Betty McKinney, the Passport program gives kids the skills they need to keep exploiting the choices they make.
And the type of skills that the job market is requiring are much different than they used to be in the past. And all of them are requiring upgrading and changing and more education. So we need to help kids know how to go about finding where can you get a school or where can you get a information that you're going to need in order to go change your career.
West Valley educators say they're pleased by Red Book's award, but the Passport Project's true merits, they say, come when graduates successfully enter their new careers or projects. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
As Alaskan elders die, one by one, voices are being extinguished. The loss of them is personal, but it is also felt beyond friends and family. Elders of every ethnic background carry with them cultural values and lifeways. If the bridge their experience might build is washed out, upcoming generations may feel its absence. Alice Stonecipher says she has felt it. She's part American Indian, but her grandfather left the reservation when he was very young, and she was not raised around Native traditions. Stonecipher feels the distance from culture may be part of the reason she found herself in trouble as a teenager.
And it was like looking for that piece of me that wasn't there, that can only be filled through knowing who I am, and part of that is my culture. And so I hope through the work that I do to be able to help young people so that they don't have to go through that lost time in their life that I did.
Stonecipher is a research assistant with a startup project called The Spirit of Our Ancestors in Fairbanks. Over the next few years, the project will begin recording the stories, thoughts, and guidance of interior Athabascan elders. While the elders themselves will determine much of the project's direction, it has been created in large part to help them speak to the next generation. Project coordinator Kathy Apollock says they've been hoping for just such a project since the parent program, Dinakanaga, was founded in 1984. Dinakanaga is a regional nonprofit that advocates for Athabascan elders and helps preserve their traditions. Kathy Apollo.
The elders met with Dinakanaga through the years saying, take down our history, you know, let us talk to the youth, let us tell them our stories, let us tell them of their past, because they're our future generation. They need to know these things. Today is such a busy world, you know, the kids are, you know, moving to the cities, they've got the VCRs, they've got the Nintendo games, you know. So much as that community closeness, I think, is disappearing.
If Pollock and Stonecipher will interview Doyon region elders, they'll also help area villages design their own preservation projects. Ipollock says an elder told her recently she thought Spirit of Our Ancestors might also help villages communicate more of themselves to visitors. Right now, the elder said, all too often the relationship is brief and pretty one-sided.
She said, we have this airline that comes in and people jump out of the plane with cameras and they take our picture. And it's like we're on show and tell or something, you know, like we're some kind of a foreign species.
The elder told Apollos she would like to see her village have something more substantial to offer, to show what life there is really like.
have something where when these people come to our village, they can come and look and see our culture, you know, not just come and take our pictures.
The Dinakanaga Spirit of Our Ancestors project has 2 years funding, time enough, the Pollock says, to get things going, to work with some of the interior's 43 villages and begin compiling a book of elder wisdom. And for researcher Alice Stonecipher, it will be a way to rebuild a bridge between generations.
And I'm hoping that by bringing the voice of the elders and the voice of the traditions, we can't separate ourselves from our past. And this will help bring the past and the future together so that the people can go into the future with more confidence and more knowing who they are and where they came from.
In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.